Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes. We are alongside the Honorable John Facciola, retired U.S. Magistrate Judge from the United States District Court of the District of Columbia. We're going to attempt to offer information, insights, and information about e-discovery innovation from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when you're interested in listening to it. Today we have what I think is a very interesting show on innovating technology in e-discovery. We're going to talk to two e-discovery technologists about the challenges of getting lawyers to open their minds and their wallets and grasp new technology, let alone use it. Every year, the most popular CLE program in the country seems to be legal tech in terms of the size of people that attend. So one would think the desire to learn new technology is rampant among lawyers. Experience, however, in the field would tend to suggest otherwise. So, you know, we thought it would be interesting to have two entrepreneur technologists on the show to talk from their perspectives on how to gain adoption of new technologies in the legal space, and it should be a lively discussion. Our participants in the show are my co-host, Judge Facciola, who's well-known in the field for his thought-provoking opinions and the speaking he's done nationally on the topic. And Judge Facciola has been a mentor for many in the field of e-discovery and is active in e-discovery education at Georgetown. And there's a rumor out there he's retired, but no one believes it. John Tredenick is our first guest, and he's the CEO and founder of Catalyst, a cloud-based e-discovery document review processing, hosting, analytics, and production platform. Over the past 30 years, John has been a tireless educator in e-discovery. He's written and edited 5 best-selling books and countless articles on litigation and technology issues. He's a pioneer in the e-discovery industry. In 2013, the American Lawyer named him among the 6 most important e-discovery trailblazers. He's been named one of the top 100 global technology leaders by London's City Tech magazine and to the 2012 Fast Case 50, which recognizes 50 of the smartest, most courageous innovators, techies, visionaries, and leaders in the law. John also served as a member of the short course faculty at the University of Virginia Law School, where he taught the course Electronic Discovery in a Global Environment and regularly lectures at other law schools and e-discovery training programs. Before starting and taking over Catalyst, John was a trial lawyer and a partner at a very large law firm where Catalyst was conceived of and started. Our other technology perspective is provided by Jay Lieb, who is the managing member of NextLP LLC, which is a data analytics software which has been received a lot of acclaim within the legal community, where they're winning a prestigious startup boot camp in Chicago leading to funding, became a front page story at LTN News in 2014, and was a very hot topic in the business startup world in Chicago. Jay has successfully founded and led software startups throughout his career. Most recently, Jay was at a Chicago-based K-Cura Corporation as the chief strategy officer. K-Cura is a Chicago-based company focused on the e-discovery vertical. Jay has more than a decade of experience in the technology field and has worked in multiple roles on some of the largest e-discovery and fraud projects in the world. Before joining K-Cura, Jay was an executive at Ernst & Young's Fraud Investigative and Dispute Services, and prior to that, Jay founded Advocate Solutions, Inc., where he invented Discovery Cracker, the world's first shrink-wrapped e-discovery processing application. Jay's software applications have been recognized by numerous surveys and awards in technology and e-discovery fields. So, glad to have you both on the show, and since you've both brought new technologies into the legal space, why don't I ask Jay and then John, is this an easy task?
I would say no, it's not an easy task, but working in this vertical, the legal vertical, is, I think, awesome, the sense that every case is like almost like its own entity itself, and there's multiple solution sets. So, no, it's not easy to bring new technology into the legal space, but I see the legal space being a very broad space that has many different kind of verticals within it and different factors. So it's been a great, I've been doing this now 17 years, and it's been a great time.
Okay, John?
Well, I just finished reading Unbroken, and compared to being on a raft for 130 days or life in a POW camp in World War II, I'd say it's a piece of cake, but if we take away those two comparisons, It's a tough job. It's like any business. People are careful with their money. There are all kinds of factors going into buyers' decisions. They want to know that you're going to provide value and something that'll make their life easier. So it's tough, but I think almost all business is tough. Everything I've seen, anyway.
Well, let me ask you this, gentlemen. Does the legal community treat you as partners in solving an e-discovery problem, or do you feel like you're treated differently than the lawyers treat each other when it comes to brainstorming on how to solve a problem that the lawyers themselves have?
Who to start on that one? I guess I will, Jay, if that's all right.
Sure.
I think it works like a lot like the law firms worked when I spent 20 years there. There's a bit of a caste system, to be candid, in the law firms. There's the, I'm a lawyer, I'm a partner, you're not. I think the lawyers had the toughest time for many, many years recognizing that the staff working alongside them brought skills to the table, brought valuable contributions to the table and the like. I think that changed some as technology moved to the forefront and people started working with folks. For example, at Holland & Hart, we brought in jury consultants who had PhDs, specialists in graphics, and then even on the technology side, you had people that clearly were very smart and talented. It just took a while for the lawyers to recognize that they were teammates. And I think the same thing works out in the, quote, vendor community.
Jay?
Yeah, I would say that I agree with John and what he's saying. I think the big difference here, though, is the first thing is you have to win the trust as far as being an advisor. If they think they're coming in purely from a sales standpoint and you say, here's the solution, but now tell me your problem, they really will look at you with cast eyes as far as what is this person trying to solve here? Is he just trying to sell me something? So I think you first have to win trust by proving out that you really are looking at after the best interests of their clients, of their cases, and really of their careers as well. Once you can prove to them in that respect, in that fashion, then you will have that trust, and they'll be open to new ideas on and trying new things.
So, Judge Facciola, you would come at it from a different perspective as a judge, and you're deeply networked within the judicial community. Do you feel that judges embrace the new technologies, or do lawyers take on more risk by trying something new?
Well, you know, it depends the context in which it occurs. I spent most of the weekend looking again and thinking about what the Supreme Court was trying to accomplish in the Daubert case and walking the fine line between encouraging innovation but making sure that the court was not inundated with what it called junk science that pops up out of nowhere and doesn't have the traditional scientific backings. In this particular area of that analytics and search, I think one would say that judges have embraced it quite quickly. I mean, we have now an opinion from Judge Peck that describes the use of predictive coding as, quotes, black letter law. That's, what, 2 or 3 years for that to come about. So I don't think you can look at the modern judiciary over the past 2 years and see resistance to lawyers coming up with, the people who help them, coming up with creative and innovative ways to do new things. To the contrary, I think judges welcome that.
You know, from my perspective, I would agree. You know, in the two, you know, largest cases I've been involved in with testing new things out in global aerospace, you know, watching Judge Chamberlain issue his opinion approving it, he just seized on proportionality and wasn't going to stand in the way of using predictive coding to try something new to save money. Just wasn't going to do it. And unfortunately, there's not an opinion written on that, but sitting in the courtroom, he was just very, very clear-cut that this is, I'm not going to stand in the way of people trying new things. You know, I've seen lots of things over my career involving change, and, you know, they want to try to save money and do it faster, cheaper. And then in Garlock, where we use the visual clustering and remote review type of an approach, you know, I had a chief clerk in the bankruptcy court in the Western District, Michael Rhodes, who just patted me on the back after I presented a concept and said, yes, let's try it. We're all about trying to support. We support you 100% doing this. And having a client or judge or whatever behind you saying, yes, try it. I mean, I think that's a big part of trying something new with technology is letting people know you're trying something new. But go ahead.
John, there's a great song by The Loving Spoonful, you know, about you got to make up your mind when to take this one and leave another behind. So I was wondering, how do lawyers grapple with the decision when you come to them with something new and they realize that this requires them to leave behind the technology with which they may have been familiar?
Well, I think that's always a tough one because there are really two costs in innovating in the legal side. One of course, is you try something new and the judge rejects it because he or she doesn't understand it, or at least you feel that way, and the other side objects and fights, and so you feel you get embarrassed by trying something and failing. But the other cost, a little bit more insidious, is quite simply that when you try something new, you're likely to be hit with hearings, briefings, experts, and the like. And so there's a cost just to try that just naturally holds people back, particularly in a profession that lives off precedent. But that said, you know, there are lawyers, just like there are people everywhere, that are going to push and try something new. I can remember back in, the early 90s when the virtual reality cameras were first coming out, and we had a case involving Coors Field, brand new ballpark, maybe mid-90s, and they were trying to keep people from selling programs on the sidewalks next to the stadium, and the debate was whether this was a public hazard, and we brought out these newfangled 360 cameras where you could just see the whole way around to show them off, and it was very effective at showing that there was a lot of space on those sidewalks. They were big, but of course the other side objected to the showing of this because they've never been tried before. And the judge says, well, I like them. And as a fallback, they said, well, I object. We have to go out and see it ourselves. And the judge says, why? I can see it right here. Objection is denied. And now they're probably commonplace. So people, there's always a force to try new things to solve problems.
Jay, do you have any insight on that?
Yeah, I do. What I've always tried to do is reduce the friction to introduce new things. And what that means to me is if you look at kind of the early time period with e-discovery, what we try to do with Discovery Cracker is not try and bring in something new, but try and represent a older paradigm. The paradigm at that time was scanning paper and TIFFing everything. So the very first versions of Discovery Cracker was focused on maintaining a paper-like paradigm that you would TIFF things, that would slip easily into tools like summation and concordance and ringtail. And so you'd give it something familiar, but solve the problem along the way. How can I get this, you know, ESI material into the database tools that I have today? And how can I utilize it the way that with my existing workflows? So that's what you see with the kind of the early discovery, the paper paradigm. I think e-discovery is now in this kind of 2.0 and maybe even 3.0 phase with predictive coding. You're seeing the same thing. You're seeing, can we treat this like a search paradigm, the way we search and use workflows before? And I think that's a good way to get acceptance with new technologies is first give them something familiar, but it solves a problem in a disruptive way. Then you can extend the capabilities and workflows with the new technology in mind.
So, you know, and getting into more of sort of a narrow, your personal experiences, and you just shared one there, Jay. John, do you have any, advice on strategies that have worked? Since we're trying to also provide mentoring here for people that want to try new things, are there strategies that have worked for you to gain acceptance of a new technology? When you started Catalyst, you must have had some interesting battles or concerns or issues. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, sure, and I think Jay made an excellent point. The more you can tie things to what people are familiar with, the more effective you'll be. And that's something you know as an advocate. When you're speaking to a jury, your whole mission is to tie your point of view with common sense. I put that in quotes, with their experiences. So when I talk about TAR or predictive ranking, predictive coding, I don't talk about it in terms of statistics or mathematics or other things. I just say it works like Pandora, which we all use. It's just like Pandora Internet Radio, and instead of picking songs, you're picking documents, but it's all the same. And if you can do that as a trial lawyer, as a business person, as somebody trying to persuade people to try something new, I think you're going to be more effective. And I think that's always the key. How can I tie this so it looks like a very, very small step, almost inevitable step from where I already am?
Judge Fatchell, that sounds like tacking and sailing from what I know a little bit about sailing. Would you agree?
Well, yes, it is. But in sailing, there's even less of a margin for error. You tack at the wrong time, you lose the race. So, but if you think about an introduction of new technologies, I mean, the America's Cup race this last year was astonishing. I'm a sailor. I got home and I saw that the boats were going 40 knots an hour. I thought it was a typo. I thought they had meant to say 4 knots an hour. But there is talk about disruptive technology, so it was quite different. Carl?
Okay. So, Jay, your technology might be more disruptive and require even more education than in the analytics side. And it's fascinating technology, having looked at it fairly deeply at times. You've also been funded through angel and VC-type funding. You know, how do you feel about making, large investments into education to get lawyers more in tune to how to use technology to solve problems, or, having technology that Wall Street might appreciate where they're making money off of spotting problems and quickly making bets? You know, do you, instead of charging clients for using a tool, they're actually making money. So do you focus on different markets where the power of capitalism might be wind behind your back, or do you charge ahead in law?
Right. There was a lot in that question, Carl.
Yeah, I know. You're a unique company.
Right. So, in full disclosure, this is the first time that I actually raised money. My other startups, I've had a few, were always bootstrapped, mostly by circumstance. When I started Discovery Cracker Advocate Solutions back in 2000, we had internet bust, and there was no money to be had. And to try and walk around and explain to people that, hey, I'm going to help lawyers get documents into their system was just not going anywhere. And I would walk around, to kind of answer the question just before that John just attacked, I would walk around up and down the streets of Chicago going to law firms, showing them my e-discovery system. We didn't even call it discovery back then. I was calling it digital discovery and all sorts of things. And I would get, a no and get kicked out of everyone's office. They would say that lawyers love paper. And some of these folks are so-called experts nowadays. Got to be honest with you. These are some very reputable people that I have a lot of respect for. But they would kick me out of their office saying lawyers love paper. And then after a little bit of time, after, a lot of no's, you would get your first couple cases and the first couple early adopters on a project. But kind of go from there. I think the key with technology to really get to be scalable is to really make it a movement where, e-discovery overall really didn't start taking off until it was a movement. It wasn't my technology. It was a variety of different angles coming at it that made it come, that had it take off. Same thing with predictive coding. It's not going to be one group's technology that really was the catalyst for this. It was a variety of factors. And obviously with Judge Peck and DeSilva Moore, that really was a kind of a seminal case that shed light, as well as a great New York Times article. So to come back to your question, I think one of the key things when you're looking at starting a business, especially in a field like legal vertical, you have to do a couple things. One, you got to have thick skin so you can take a lot of no's. Two, when you find a case that the technology can work on, you got to work really hard on it. You got to exceed expectations for that client, because obviously they're putting a lot of trust in you to make the uh, that the that the representations you make of your technology is correct, it's helping their client. And the training kind of falls, comes out of that. It comes as a process. To start a in my opinion, to start a training program on something that hasn't gained movement yet is tough, because it falls into more of a sales-like experience. People want to hear about stories of how you solve problems, how you won the case, and everyone went home happy. So I think the education piece is in collaboration with early adopters, with clients. And then the last piece of the question, as far as how do I talk to VCs and other groups? Well, if you could solve a real problem, there'll be money to be made there. If you're solving a problem in a highly efficient way, and it's something that people have to do, it's not an option. That's why you know I've loved working in this field for so long, because this is not an option. It has to be done. They need to have technologies. They need to be able to do this as efficiently as possible and keep their clients' best interest at hand. So there'll be money to be had. Now, what's great about the kind of the newer technology, like our technology with Story Engine, is that there's natural product extensions. You know, working in e-discovery and in fraud investigations, you could see that many of the issues that we face are kind of downstream activities that came that could have been prevented early on, or at least greatly minimized. So we're naturally looking at how can we move upstream and help things in a kind of a more proactive manner.
John, they say, you know, a rising tide raises all the boats, but this year one of the boats went down. Earlier this year, Kroll, which I always associated with this in this field as being a prominent player, went bankrupt. Has that given you any pause on this whole question of selling innovative software solutions to lawyers? They seem to push hard on that, but unfortunately it didn't break their way. What do you think, John?
Well, first, I've got to say that we should be careful in what conclusions we draw from the Kroll bankruptcy, because you know well, and I know from practicing, that people take bankruptcy for a lot of reasons, and not just because they're going out of business. So Kroll was owned by Altegrity. I'm no expert in their financial dealings, but it's very possible that Altegrity is in trouble and that Kroll itself was not.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they needed to file a bankruptcy of all the entities so that they could classically clear off debt and do other things. So I don't know for a fact. I don't know the details that the Kroll itself was struggling. It's still a respected player in the market. You're not going to hear a bad word from me about them. But that said, what we have seen are lots of companies. I mean, I've been at it 15 years, and I've watched companies come and go. I've watched people march in and say, "Sell me your software at a price you like, or I'll just build it myself," and then watch them blow $15 million trying to do that because it was harder than they thought. What I can say is that in any business, and there's nothing special about the legal side, but any business, you've got to make decisions about people, capital, where the market's going, where you're going to invest your efforts. To me, the classic one was WordPerfect. You have a company that was on top of the world that really got upset at Bill Gates and Microsoft and decided that OS2 was the future of the industry, and that they were going to build their word processor on OS2. For those who can remember that far back, at least, well, OS2 was interesting, and it was proffered by IBM, but it was not the future of the industry. They just bet wrong, and they never recovered from it. So whether or not Kroll is in trouble itself or bet wrong, I don't know. But we've watched the companies come and go by making bad bets, and it's just part of the industry. It's that invisible hand of the market that will slap you in the face if you're not really careful. And so it's a reality we all live through. I know it from Catalyst side. We've been very careful. We've got no debt, a lot of money in the bank. We've always taken the bus in from LaGuardia, Priceline. We've just always watched every penny and been through two major recessions. So I think it's how you approach business and, of course, whether or not you actually do deliver a service that that people need and they'll pay for that, that keeps you going.
You know, yeah, go ahead.
I was just saying, Carl, is that, you know, I don't want to get specific into Kroll because I don't know the situation like John said, but, you know, the same thing that happens with service companies are same kinds of things that happen with like law firms and other kind of professional services firms that you have to be careful managing. The sense of the rainmaker's dilemma, that you win a big case, a big project, you have the entire company or organization or a large portion of it dedicated to that case. You staff up. You're all in on that case with that client. It goes on for a number of years. And then when that case settles or ends or starts to sunset, you now have this large infrastructure built, and you have to keep feeding that pipeline over and over again. So as an industry, it's really important to manage your capital, like John just said, but also be able to take a longer purview of how to satisfy clients, how to do it in an efficient manner, how to have even just how do you go to market, how you sell, how your differentiators are, so that you don't have to have this rainmaker's dilemma where you're constantly staffing up for one case. Then when it goes, you have to try again and again, because that's it's really hard to keep sustaining that when you have these choppy revenue streams like that.
Carl?
Yeah, so we I think we already talked about TAR and where we see it going at this point. So why don't we sort of end up here with education and
John, you know,
yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's interesting. I just had a recent experience that bears on this. I spoke to bankruptcy lawyers about electronic discovery, and their concern was a very significant one, which was bankruptcy is always the kind of case where nobody has much money. How do you scale this down? So I guess it leads to the question for both Jay and John is, what do you see as being the relationship between what we all do in terms of education and meeting needs like that one?
And that one judges the scale it down?
Yeah. In other words, what is the relationship if they go to a CLE and they hear you and they hear Jay and they hear me and they hear Carl? They instantly turn off and say, oh, that's the big case. That's the big guys. And in effect, the education is lost on them. And I just wondered, what, if anything, we could do to meet their needs? How do we explain them today to them in an educational context what this is and how it's going to work for their unique problems?
Well, Jay, if you don't mind, I'll take a first crack at it and then turn it to you. Judge, it's a really common reaction, and it's been common for as long as I can remember. I go back to the days when the first imaging systems were coming online, and the debate was, well, how big did the case need to be before you'd think about something like images? Was it 10,000 docs? Remember when that was a big case, by the way, or 20 or 30? And even today, as we moved into the bigger platforms, even before TAR, the question was, how big did they need to be? And the answer, ironically, was they can be as small as you want, particularly if you're pricing by size, by the gig, by what have you. You can have 100 documents in a system if it's automated and built so that you can fire it up and get it going in moments and perhaps get use out of it. And of course, 100 documents is stretching the point, but it's not 10,000 or 100,000 or a million. On the TAR side, though, people absolutely were right to think that it required big cases at first in what I call the TAR 1.0 world, because there were a lot of kind of formalistic starting things you had to do. You had to get a senior expert, and he or she had to tag 500 documents and then train with 4,000, 3,000, 4,000, then tag more and go through a lot of upfront efforts before you even got yourself into using it. In the TAR tool world, most or all of that goes away, and literally you can fire up a case with thousands of documents. You don't have to have millions. Let the review team go at it. So, for example, if you had 10,000 documents to review, and I could convince you that with a TAR system, you might be able to stop after reviewing 3,000 or 4,000.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see a client in my 20 years that didn't understand that if I could knock out, let's say, 7,000 documents from the review at $2 or $3 a document, that'd be a good thing. And so these systems, once you build them to scale, can actually work very easily for anybody. Gmail, for example, is built to handle massive amounts of email, and yet you can use it yourself individually. And that's really what technology brings, I think, this ability to use it across a much wider spectrum than ever before. Okay?
Jay?
Yeah. So I guess there's just a couple thoughts on this. First off, just on the kind of the macro level, bankruptcy and recession, those are usually pretty good times for e-discovery from and discovery in general. There's creditor actions, there's the lawsuits being filed. It's always been a pretty good time as far as the industry goes. So from that perspective, just on the macro level, it's important for folks in that field to understand this. Secondly, when you think about being very efficient with your dollar, if it's an insurance payout or as far as creditor action goes, or some kind of VC, et cetera, using these types of tools are highly efficient and highly effective. So I would look towards this as a solution. Now, one of the things that's important, though, is how is the solutions being used? And when I was talking about the kind of paradigm, you know, this kind of this 1.0 of predictive coding is really kind of like salary arbitrage, meaning first, Carl's really an expert in both predictive coding and in contract review, but you know, contract review became kind of a salary arbitrage instead of having associates and partners review documents. We'd use contract reviewers as a salary arbitrage at a lower cost. Then what we said is, okay, let's take technology, put it in there, and let's use that for salary arbitrage to cool down the document set. That's really, to me, the 1.0 of predictive coding. What our technology is trying to do is be that 2.0, using artificial intelligence to give more insights. So not just have it as a substitute for a human being as far as an arbitrage situation or as a substitute for searching, but to give more insights to understand more about your data, to be able to make decisions earlier and faster on throughout the entire life cycle. So it doesn't have to be a large case. It could be an extremely small case as well. It could be our technology works on a doc-by-doc level, much like a human would work.
Carl?
Yeah, it's striking. First of all, I feel like I have to say something. Now that I've had two of my guests on the show, I've started talk about reducing review and, you know, being in the review space. I looked at the name of our company, Review Less. So I guess it's sort of we're forcing ourselves out of business. I laugh about it. But I think unfortunately that is one of the misunderstandings that people have about leveraging technology is that at the end of the day, you're trying to tell a story and win a case, not do a production. And there's still plenty of need for the best reviewers behind the best technologies. That's you know, technology 2.0 or 3.0, which I think everyone wants us to get to. And you know, I look at the names that we have for doing review, you know, first pass review and second pass review. Doesn't that just say to you did a poor job on the first pass? You know, shouldn't we do a one pass review? And sort of that's where I've been personally, where we've been fixated is trying to, you know, work with the technologies and the better reviewers and workflows. But it faces the same challenges we've talked about this entire show about gaining early adopters and tying it into the original workflow so it doesn't seem so mysterious. So, you know, I have found this to be just a fascinating discussion and applicable across any change in the legal space.
It has led me to give all of you a job. And it is this. Could you ever imagine yourselves creating a tool that a judge could use that would be sensitive to concerns about security and privacy, but would nevertheless equip the judge to do searches, for example, when he gets a 1,000-entry privilege log remember, judges have no independent technology. Is that a challenge you any of you wish to undertake?
Sounds like a user interface challenge.
Yeah, there might even be money to pay you.
You know, Judge, when you talk about the searching, I can tell you that it's rare, but we have on occasions for some pretty big companies hosted arbitrations where all three parties had access.
Yeah, if that's what I did in my case called Elamine, Judge Colicatelli and I created a database for common use by the parties in the court, and she issued what really I suppose is one of the first electronic opinions in American history. But that is rare, and there is this technology deficit on the judicial side, and it would be interesting to see people like you give it some thought.
Well, we'll give it some thought. Now, the sort of area where I'm ending up on here is, and I wrote an article a while back for Forbes about in 2011 about how technology and law play together, and lawyers seem to, you know, not embrace technologists when creating rules or, you know, trying new things. John, you know, you've been both. You've been an attorney and a technology entrepreneur. Are you happier, you know, as a technologist, entrepreneur, or attorney? You know, which have you enjoyed more professionally?
Well, Carl, I get that question pretty commonly. And I know people are expecting me to have an answer going one direction or another, but it's not really correct. What I had was a chance to actually have two careers. So I spent 20-plus years with Holland and Hart, a great group, 10 offices across the Rockies, and got to practice law at every level of the courts. And you guys will know that there were days when you're on top of the world, you're a genius. There are days when you wish the floor would open a hole in front of you that you could jump in. I mean, it's a tough business, it's challenging, but it's very rewarding. I then had a chance to try a whole different life and a whole different business. And building a business is awful tough. And there are days when you wish that hole would open and you could crawl in, that you make mistakes and what have you. But it is about building something and building teams and working together, hopefully to build something good, something you're proud of. And I wouldn't give up that experience either for all the money in the world. But I'm not going to give the speech of, God, I couldn't wait to get out of law, and I suffered, and it was awful because I had a ball in the legal field. So I loved them both, and really what I'm telling you is I'd love to have a chance to take on two careers.
That's a good – so, Jay, do you want to go to law school now? Do you want that second career?
Right. It's an extremely honorable field. My wife's a prosecutor here in Chicago, and she puts people in jail, which is probably the most honorable thing you can do as far as community service goes. You know, I'm an MBA, and I think I bring a unique skill set and perspective to cases from both technology side as well as just the business side. That's sometimes what you have to do in cases, too. When you start talking about solutions, you really have to keep a business perspective on it. Is it worth using this technology? Is it cost feasible? Will you get return on investment? I mean, these are all things. I think these are concepts that are now more relevant than ever before in this field. So I kind of sidestepped the question.
Yeah, having been both, I gotta say I didn't get to the partner summit like John, so it's harder for me. I was still in that caste system trenches, but you know, had the moments. But I love the freedom of being an entrepreneur and being able to try to solve problems without trying to attach a time limit to it. Is sort of the biggest difference I point to. Judge, you want to get anything out of these guys on
no,
if they
just
could improve
to tell them
anything?
How exciting it has been, and I just keep thinking about the British politician who looked at the U.S. Constitution and was asked for his reaction. He said, well, all sail, no anchor. Wow. while we beat up lawyers, we have to remember that sometimes there has to be a force in a society that recalls to everyone's attention how things were done previously and that they worked before we try a new way. So the wonderful balance these two gentlemen bring to that is a wonderful thing to see.
Yeah, so I think it's been a great show. I want to thank Jay Leib and John Tredanik for joining us today in our discussion, and to Judge Facciola for keeping me interested in doing these ESI Bites programs with this newer format. If you have any questions about this show or this particular format or any other programs at ESI Bites, please feel free to email me at kas@reviewless.com. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bites. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I encourage you to go to www.esibites.com for a complete list of our show. And as we always say, come to ESI Bites, learn more about e-discovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Schinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.